Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, April 13th, 2023. Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing the arrest of a 21-year-old Air Force National Guardsman in Massachusetts, Jack Teixeira, in connection with the leak of classified Pentagon documents on the war in Ukraine and U.S. relations with allies. As President Joe Biden downplaying any strategic or political fallout from the leaks. We'll also talk with Washington Post technology reporter Drew Harwell about his paper's investigation of the suspected Pentagon leaker, and also how this leak, originating in a private online chat room, is a little different than classified leaks in the past. President Biden spending another day in Ireland, meeting with that country's president and prime minister, and speaking to the Irish Parliament, telling them our history, yours and mine, reminds us the responsibilities we have to the present, to the hopes of our ancestors, to the expectation of future generations. White House reacting to the U.S. Appeals Court ruling limiting the distribution of the abortion pill mifepristone. Calls by some elected Democrats for Senator Dianne Feinstein of California to resign. She's been away from Washington recovering from an illness. While some other Democrats say those calls to resign have not happened when a male senator is sick. And on the global economy, we'll hear from World Bank President David Malpass about talks to restructure national debt of developing countries. And we start with the investigation into the leak of the Pentagon classified documents. Before the Justice Department's announcement of an arrest of a suspect, President Biden was asked about this during his trip to Ireland as he met with the Irish president at the president's residence in Dublin.
Mr. President, could you give an update on that leak investigation, the leaked documents from DOD?
I can't right now. There is a full-blown investigation going on, as you know, with the intelligence community and the Justice Department, and they're getting close. I don't have an answer.
How concerned are you about this leak?
Are you concerned about our relationship?
Are you concerned about the leak?
Okay, guys, it's time to go. Let's go. Cool, we got to move.
I'm not concerned about the leak, and I'm concerned that it happened. But there's nothing contemporaneous that I'm aware of that is of great consequence.
President Biden in Dublin, Ireland. Later in the day, as NBC News reports it, Jack Teixeira, a 21-year-old member of the Massachusetts Air National Guard, was arrested by federal authorities in connection with their investigation into classified documents that were leaked on the internet. U.S. officials had been searching for the source of the leak, which exposed potentially hundreds of pages of intelligence about Russian efforts in Ukraine and spying on U.S. allies. And at the Justice Department in Washington, Attorney General Merrick Garland with the announcement.
I'm joined today by Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco and FBI Director Paul Bate. Today, the Justice Department arrested Jack Douglas Teixeira in connection with an investigation into alleged unauthorized removal, retention, and transmission of classified national defense information. Teixeira is an employee of the United States Air Force National Guard. FBI agents took Teixeira into custody earlier this afternoon without incident. He will have an initial appearance at the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. I want to thank the FBI, Justice Department prosecutors, and our colleagues at the Department of Defense for their diligent work on this case. This investigation is ongoing. We will share more information at the appropriate time. Thanks, everyone.
Attorney General Merrick Garland at the Justice Department in Washington. 1-minute statement, not taking any questions from reporters. Washington Post writes, the arrest came hours after people familiar with the case, speaking on the condition of anonymity, identified the individual, Jack Teixeira, as the primary focus of the investigation. Washington Post reported Wednesday that the individual who leaked the information shared documents with a small circle of online friends on the Discord chat platform, which is popular with gamers. In that group, these people said Jack Teixeira's handle was Jack the Dripper. Well, this was all unfolding Thursday. Congressman Mike Turner, Republican from Ohio, chair of the Intelligence Committee, was interviewed on MSNBC.
The documents so far that we've been able to see publicly are static, meaning they're pictures at a specific point in time. And that means that we have the ability to change those circumstances. They don't necessarily reflect ongoing operations and they don't reflect a compromise of ongoing operations. They certainly give, as the Department of Defense has said yesterday in its briefing, an opportunity to mitigate any damage that has occurred as a result of these. But as you just reported from the Washington Post story and from the audio of the interview that you played, you know, this is certainly chilling because we're going to get this individual. This is a crime. This is espionage. And this involves real people. I mean, this can hurt real people, and real people could be killed and lose their lives over leaks of classified information. To make this all the way down to where it seems almost like a game to these individuals is certainly very chilling.
Now, apparently there were many people in this chat room, including foreign people who might have been exploiting it for purposes even before it was made public, where we could mitigate. So there are foreign actors who could very well have been involved in this, including from Russia.
Right, absolutely. This is very dangerous. And, you know, I can tell you around the world every day, there are people who at great sacrifice go to work and handle classified documents and information that keep our country and our allies safe. When you hear stories like this of someone who's doing this for aggrandizement for the purposes of promoting themselves, especially with just kids and are looking this almost as a game itself, it certainly raises the specter of the question of, you know, what do we need to do to make certain that our classified information is held more closely? How do we find these people before they do this, before classified documents are compromised? And then, of course, the hunt as we are now on and finding this individual, bringing them to justice for the crimes they've committed.
Congressman Mike Turner, Republican from Ohio, chair of the Intelligence Committee, today on MSNBC. More now on the Pentagon classified document leak investigation. We're joined on the phone by Drew Harwell, technology reporter with The Washington Post. Thank you for being with us. You wrote an article about how this intelligence documents leak is not like the ones in the past. How is that?
In the past, you know, with Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, there was often an intermediary. You know, they went to journalists to get their message out. They had WikiLeaks, or there was a use of, intelligence for whistleblower purposes. This is very different because it all relied on Discord, this chat platform that's really popular with gamers, can be used by anybody, is totally anonymous. Totally online. And so, you know, whoever leaked these documents and somebody has been arrested for it, they didn't need any kind of middleman. They didn't need the media or journalists. They didn't need whistleblower. They just went straight to the internet and got their message across. So that's, I think, really sort of underlines the challenge for the government in keeping secret documents in close to the vest, but also just, you know, all of us in terms of we're never really going to know how this information gets spread when an anonymous source can push a button and push this around the world.
And it seemed from the reporting that this was not a leak for nefarious purposes off the bat. It was sort of a joke.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, there was about 20 people on this really private Discord server. They were all very close. They even called each other family, and they were all kind of interested in geopolitics and guns and war. And it sounds like from talking to members in it that one of them had, you know, security clearance, had access to these confidential materials and used them to gain clout among that group, to, you know, sort of be on the inside of this big story. We don't really have a sense that there was any grand political motivation. And the members we've talked to have said, you know, they're not, some of these documents are about the Ukraine war. They're not for Russia or for Ukraine. So it really was just kind of an interest in the goods. They had the secrets. They wanted to share them and talk about them and laugh about them. And so that, you know, gets to it too. This is not a standard whistleblower case of somebody trying to expose wrongdoing. This is just sharing secrets for a laugh and because you can.
The Washington Post broke some news on this overnight that I guess led to the arrest today of a suspect. How did the Post uncover the information?
You know, we were able to track back through these Discord servers. So this information is all around the world now, but the original places where they were shared was one specific Discord server that's called Thugs Shaker Central. And so we were able to find some of the members, and again, the small Discord that had 20 to 30 members, And we were able to talk to some of them, and we were able to establish that this was a community where people were really close to each other. They had gotten closer through the pandemic, where they were isolated, spending their lives online, and they took it too far. Somebody had access to this information because they worked at on a military base. They had clearance enough that they could go into a secure facility like a SCIF and bring documents out. So, you know, this was a case of just people, misusing their ability to see documents, one person doing that, and then sharing it with their buddies to make a point to establish some credibility, and it just all went too far.
We're talking with Drew Harwell, technology reporter for The Washington Post. You also write at WashingtonPost.com. The episode throws a spotlight on the evolution of social media. How have things changed?
We all are online. We are all exchanging information with each other. We're building relationships with each other. We're going through our work lives, whether we work on a military base or in a newsroom, and we're taking that live with us online. And so, you know, you have these mainstream social media platforms like Facebook, where we're all sort of talking to each other in a public way. We have some expectations that what we're saying is going to be seen or can be seen by anybody. But then, you know, we're starting to go into more of these closed groups, too, where we have group chats. People use Discord, and there's a different level of expectation. There's a feeling like I'm just talking with my friends, and I can maybe be a little more open and maybe push the boundaries a little bit. And so when you have that connected to people who have access to information they shouldn't be sharing, there's going to be, you know, an incentive and a drive for people to connect the two and maybe, you know, use that in their friendship. And so it's a wild case to see this playing out, because it really does have geopolitical significance. These are records that are to the Ukraine war, to American espionage. The stakes really could not be higher. And yet there's a real more human story of people trying to use what they got to establish their friendship. So I think that's really interesting. We're only going to be dealing with it more as we live more of our lives online.
Drew Harwell, technology reporter for The Washington Post. You can find his stories at WashingtonPost.com and on Twitter at Drew Harwell. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder is saying today that the leak of classified documents was a deliberate criminal act. And he said at his news conference at the Pentagon that the Defense Department has taken steps to review distribution lists to ensure that people receiving information had a need to know.
In the days after the leaks came to light, what steps has DOD taken to reduce the number of people who have access to not only these classified briefings, but the classified material in general?
Sure. So we continue to review a variety of factors as it relates to safeguarding classified materials. This includes examining and updating distribution lists, assessing how and where intelligence products are shared, and a variety of other steps. I would say, though, that it is important to understand that we do have stringent guidelines in place for safeguarding classified and sensitive information. This was a deliberate criminal act, a violation of those guidelines. And so, again, I think that's important to understand. Now, we will continue to do everything we can to ensure that people who have a need to know when it comes to this kind of information have access to that. We're always going to learn from every situation. But again, this is something that we'll continue to look at.
But you are taking steps to tighten that, I guess, population who might have access to this level of information.
That's accurate. Again, we continue to review those distribution lists, update them, make sure there's a need to know. But again, let me just emphasize my point that this was a, you know, we have rules in place. Each of us signs a non-disclosure agreement. Anybody that has a security clearance. And so all indications are, again, this is a criminal act, a willful violation of those. Another reason why we're continuing to investigate and support DOJ's investigation.
Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder, also an Air Force Brigadier General, at the Pentagon news conference today. The leaked U.S. intelligence documents included revelations that the United States is spying not only on adversaries such as Iran and North Korea, but also allies, including Great Britain, Canada, South Korea, and Israel. And the Prime Minister of Poland, Mateusz Morawiecki, was asked today if his country, a NATO member, close ally of the U.S., may be more wary about sharing intelligence in the future.
My answer is no. I'm not going to think twice. I believe that, you know, failures happen and mistakes happen. And, you know, we have to be as close as possible with our allies in Western Europe and with United States. And we want to be a binder of those two dimensions, by the way, which are now going somehow different directions. So I know that there is this leakage. It happens. By the way, Russian cyber threats are extremely are to be taken extremely seriously. They are very efficient in propaganda, very effective in spreading fake news, propaganda, stealing data, and so on. So we have to unite on this front as well.
Prime Minister of Poland Mateusz Morawiecki at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. This is Washington Today. Back to Dublin, Ireland, and President Joe Biden's visit. One of his stops today was the residence of the Irish president, where, in the yard, the president, President Biden, became the first U.S. president to ring the peace bell, a bell that was commissioned in 2008 to mark the 10th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. That's the peace deal in Northern Ireland to stop decades of guerrilla war between the nationalists wanting to reunite with the Republic of Ireland and the unionists who wanted to the area to remain part of Great Britain. And this year is the 25th anniversary of the agreement. President Biden ringing the bell four times for Ireland, for the United States, for his Irish ancestors, and for peace.
Fourth one for peace. Thank you, man.
President Biden at the Irish Prime Minister's residence in Dublin. Standing beside him, President Michael Higgins. President Biden also shoveling dirt around a freshly planted Irish oak, not far from one that was planted years ago by then-President Barack Obama. President Biden, after ringing the bell and shoveling the dirt, came over and spoke with reporters about his trip.
Mr. President, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling great and learned a lot hanging out with the president.
How was the old president?
It feels great. You know, I know it sounds silly, but there's so many Irish Americans like my relatives who got here and got to America in 1844, 45, and 46, who've never been back here. And they talk about it. The interesting thing, I know many of you have the same experience with your ancestry wherever the country of origin was. But you hear all these stories about, you know, what it was like back in Ireland. They heard from their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. And the thing, my first trip over here, when I went to the Boyne, and I looked down and my grandfather Finnegan used to say, his grandfather Owen Finnegan, Scranton used to say, Scranton, Pennsylvania is just like the Boyne Valley. And I thought, how can that be? Well, you stand there and you look, and Scranton, there's a river runs through it called the Lackawanna River, and a mountain on either side in the valley, and where we live, you could look down and see, you could see how 100 years earlier, it would look like the Boyne. And there's all those things. Anyway, it's just so great to always have an excuse to come back.
President Biden in Dublin at the Irish Prime Minister's house, speaking to reporters. The two of them also took in a demonstration of boys and girls athletics, playing traditional Irish sports, the boys playing Gaelic football and the girls playing a sport called camgee. It's a little like a combination of field hockey and lacrosse. President Biden in Dublin then visiting the Irish Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, at the official Irish guest state house of Farmley. And then it was off to speak at the Irish Parliament. He was introduced by the chair of the lower house, Sean O'Fergale, who highlighted the economic ties between the two countries.
Our two countries enjoy a warm, close, and mutually beneficial relationship. It has been an enduring relationship built on shared values and shared economic interests, as well as a passion for politics and a love of culture matters that you have highlighted, Mr. President, frequently. Economically, Ireland has benefited immensely from US investment, which supports over 370,000 jobs in Ireland today. As a result, we now have thriving technology, healthcare, and financial services sectors. Less spoken about, however, Mr. President, are the 650-plus Irish companies that operate across all 50 states of the Union, employing over 100,000 people, and the fact that Ireland today is the ninth largest source of foreign direct investment in the United States. Long may this bilateral investment continue. Erská a chéile a Warren Nadine.
Leader of the Irish Parliament's lower house, Sean O'Fergale, introducing President Biden today in Parliament. President Biden went on to talk about, as well, the economy, Irish and the U.S., and business investment, and the Good Friday Agreement, 25th anniversary, and his Irish heritage. And near the end of his speech, he quoted one of his favorite Irish poets who passed away about 10 years ago and whose widow was in the audience.
As was mentioned, today's Seamus Heaney's birthday. And I was always quoting Irish poetry in the United States Senate over my career. It's a long career, 36 years. And my colleagues always thought I did it because I was Irish. That's not the reason. I'm the best poets in the world. That's the reason I did it. And one of the best among them. Was your husband, and thank you for sending me that autographed copy. Was your husband. My favorite poem was The Cure of Troy. And it goes, you all know the words. You know it, you just heard it so many times. He wrote, don't hope on this side of the grave, but then, once in a lifetime, that longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. It's everything I've been taught. Rise up. We've in the past made hope and history rhyme. So today, ladies and gentlemen, as we celebrate the enduring partnership between our nations, our shared past, our present, let's set our eyes squarely on the future. Let's harness what's best in us, our courage, our creativity, our loyalty, our tenacity, and our loyalty again. Let's once more, for our generation and generation to come, strive to make hope and history rhyme. Because I've never been more optimistic about the future than I am today. And I'm at the end of my career, not the beginning.
President Biden speaking to the Parliament in Dublin, Ireland. You can find his full speech on our website at cspan.org. Associated Press writing, according to the Irish Family History Center, Joe Biden is among the most Irish of all U.S. presidents. 10 of his 16 great-great-grandparents were from the Emerald Isle. And that he'll also attend a gala dinner on Thursday and visit County Mayo, another ancestral area on the West Coast, on Friday before returning to Washington, D.C. And Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcast and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. The Justice Department is asking the U.S. Supreme Court for an emergency order to put on hold any action from a federal appeals court ruling Wednesday night that the abortion pill mifepristone can still be used but cannot be sent through the mail and can only be taken within 7 weeks of pregnancy instead of 10 weeks. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals narrowed a ruling from a lower court judge in Texas that had blocked the Food and Drug Administration's 20-year-old approval of the abortion pill altogether. Some reaction to this from the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, who held a news conference in Dublin, Ireland, traveling with the president.
An appeals court ruled overnight on the abortion pill matter. They blocked part of the ruling from Texas, but they kept other parts in place, including restrictions on receiving it by mail and a requirement to visit a doctor in person. Can you comment specifically on those elements that will remain in place and perhaps say how the White House and the administration will respond?
So it goes back to what I said earlier this week, which is that we are going to continue to fight in the courts. We believe that the law is on our side and we will prevail. So that I can reassure the American people that is our commitment to women, millions of women across the country, and also providers who are at the front lines, working every day to make sure that women are able to make decisions for themselves about their own body. So what we can say is we're going to continue to fight. We're going to promise to do that for Americans across the country, and we believe we will prevail because we believe that the law is on our side.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters in Dublin. AP writes that the lawsuit challenging the drug's approval was brought by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which also argued for overturning Roe v. Wade and indicated it was content for now in the mifepristone case. Aaron Hawley, an attorney for the group, said it had no plans to seek an appeal that might restore the Texas court's full ruling. She says the Fifth Circuit's decision is a significant victory for the doctors we represent, women's health, and every American who deserves an accountable federal government acting within the bounds of the law. More about the Federal Appeals Court ruling, C-SPAN spoke with Alina Salganikov, Senior Vice President and Director of Women's Health at KFF.
I think an important thing for people to understand about mifepristone is that the drug has been very severely restricted in terms of its distribution over the years. Initially, the drug was approved. Only physicians could provide this medication. It was only recommended up to 7 weeks of pregnancy. It required 3 visits. You had to dispense this and start taking the medication in person, and the dose was actually 3 times higher than is recommended today. So over the years, as with many other drugs, the FDA has changed these restrictions as more information has come in about the safety and effectiveness and the best use of this drug. So most recently in 2023, a new set of REMS, it's called Risk Evaluation Mitigation Strategy. And those are the conditions that the FDA applies to certain drugs. And what they said is that the REMS now had been changed and now you can mail the drug safely. The dosage was actually lowered in 2016 to 200 milligrams. And the dates in which it's effective in the pregnancy was expanded from 7 weeks to 10 weeks. The ruling of the Fifth Circuit rolls back the clock to 2000. And so what that means is the drug can no longer be mailed. It's only approved up to 7 weeks of pregnancy. Only doctors can dispense this medication and it must be done in person. So of course that's going to dramatically limit the distribution of this medication by rolling back the clock.
Alina Salganikov, Senior Vice President and Director of Women's Health at KFF, formerly the Kaiser Family Foundation, on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this morning. Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, saying today that Senator Dianne Feinstein, also Democrat from California, her offer to temporarily leave the Judiciary Committee rather than resign is not good enough. Senator Feinstein, 89 years old, has been away from Washington since March, still recovering from a case of shingles that put her in the hospital. She's now been released, but says her medical team has not given her clearance to travel back to D.C. It was after Congressman Khanna and Congressman Dean Phillips, Democrat from Minnesota, called on Senator Feinstein to resign that she made the offer to leave the Judiciary Committee. Her absences have been holding up judicial nominations. Democrats have only an 11-10 majority over the Republicans, and with her absence, it's a 10-10 tie, and ties lose. Congressman Khanna was interviewed on CNN today.
First of all, let me just say this. I have an enormous amount of respect for Senator Dianne Feinstein. She has had an extraordinary career in public service. She's been an icon on issues of gun violence and women's rights. But it has become painfully obvious to many of us in California that she is no longer able to fulfill her duties. She doesn't have a clear return date. We haven't been able to confirm judges at a time where women's rights and voting rights are under assault. Senator Durbin himself, who's the chair of Judiciary, has said that the reason we're not being able to move these judges is because Senator Feinstein isn't there. And so as someone from California, I felt an obligation to say what so many colleagues are saying in private, that the time has come for her to gracefully step down and have a dignified end to a very distinguished political career.
Overnight, she said, Dianne Feinstein said that she wanted the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to temporarily appoint someone to take her place on the committee. Does that alleviate any of your concerns, or do you still want her to resign?
It's a step, but as has been reported, it's not that simple. Any single senator, a Republican senator, can object to that. Senator Schumer has done the right thing. He said he's going to try to get that done in the Senate. But we have to see if that's even possible. And I guess my question is, why not just take the step and resign instead of going through all of these motions? But I will say it's constructive. The most urgent issue is that we can get our judges confirmed.
Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, on CNN this morning. Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, also Democrat from California and a former House Speaker, asked her view by reporters on Wednesday.
Your thoughts on what Senator Feinstein should or shouldn't do?
Senator Feinstein has been a champion for California. For 20 years, I have been the leader or the Speaker of the House fighting for California, and I have seen up close and firsthand her great leadership for our country, but especially for our state of California. She deserves the respect to get well and be back on duty. And it's interesting to me. I don't know what political agendas are at work that are going after Senator Feinstein in that way. I've never seen them go after a man who was sick in the Senate in that way.
Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, speaking to reporters in San Francisco on Wednesday. That from KPIX-TV. A spokesperson for the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer putting out a statement: per Senator Feinstein's wishes, Majority Leader Schumer will ask the Senate next week to allow another Democratic senator to temporarily serve on the Judiciary Committee. An article at Vox Media says to do so, Senator Schumer needs either unanimous consent, the agreement of all present senators, or 60 votes, which would require 10 Republicans to sign on. At this point, no Republicans have expressed their opposition to replacing Senator Feinstein, though it's possible some GOP members could try to stymie the move in a bid to block judges from getting confirmed. And Democrats haven't yet announced who Senator Feinstein's replacement could be. That from Vox. Also, from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, who has been away recovering from a bad fall. He's tweeting, "I am looking forward to returning to the Senate on Monday. We've got important business to tackle and big fights to win for Kentuckians and the American people." This is Washington Today. U.S. Agency for International Development issuing a press release that begins, "USAID and U.S. International Development Finance Corporation signed today a memorandum of understanding with the government of Ukraine to support attracting investments to Ukraine as part of their efforts to help address the country's urgent development priorities and economic recovery." The USAID Administrator Samantha Power talked about the strategy, encouraging private investment in Ukraine not only to rebuild after Ukraine presumably wins the war against Russia's invasion, but also to win the war in the first place. She spoke at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce holding a program in Washington today about Ukraine.
I know you are all well aware of the potential rewards of being an early investor in an economy poised for material growth, poised for far deeper integration with European neighbors in the years ahead. The questions for many are not about the potential rewards. The questions are about the risks of investing amidst an invasion, and the risks of investing in an economy where the regulatory and governance environment does increase the costs of doing business. And here I just want to say two things. First, profoundly, every contribution to Ukraine's economy right now is a contribution to winning the war. That's not necessarily part of your business model, but we're all humans, we're all citizens, that really matters. As you consider the risks, I hope that you will also consider the stakes, the human stakes, the stakes for the values that we all hold dear. Second, I'd also urge you to give a fresh look at how the risks have changed even since the start of the war. And know that whatever caution you have identified or whatever stands in the way, whatever that barrier to entry is for you, we in the U.S. government, as I know you've heard already this morning, want to work with you to mitigate those risks and to try to bring down those barriers as best we can. We are investing heavily in partnership with the Ukrainian government and fellow democracies and multilateral institutions in reducing the costs of doing business in Ukraine. And we are committed to doing more right alongside all of you.
Samantha Power is Administrator of USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, speaking at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, U.S.-Ukraine Partnership Forum in Washington today, featuring business executives, government officials, and, as the chamber puts it, thought leaders to discuss needs and opportunities in Ukraine. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov says that Russia may be willing to discuss a prisoner swap for detained Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, but only after a Russian espionage charge against him is resolved. Foreign Minister telling Russia's state-run news agency TASS that talks about a potential prisoner swap can be examined only after a court delivers its verdict. The World Bank IMF spring meetings continuing in Washington, D.C. One of the agenda items is debt relief for developing countries. Story at Reuters has this: the latest bid by the world's leading institutions and creditors to speed up debt restructurings and get bankrupt countries back on their feet has been greeted by a mix of cautious optimism and weary skepticism by veteran crisis watchers. Standoffs between major Western-backed lenders like the International Monetary Fund and the world's top bilateral creditor, China, have been blamed for keeping countries such as Zambia mired in default for nearly 3 years. The World Bank President David Malpass held a news conference today in Washington and asked about this issue.
I just wanted to ask regarding the debt roundtable that took place yesterday. How much progress was really made, and where is the situation relative to where you want it to be at this point in time on debt relief and restructuring for low-income countries? Thank you.
Thanks. Restructurings mean you actually get to a change in the debt contract so that there's more sustainability for the country. That can be done by changing the interest rate on a loan or by extending the maturity. It can be done by lowering the principal amount of the loan. So those are the ultimate goal for the countries. The common framework, the G20's common framework process, sought to get that started, but World Bank and IMF have looked for ways to improve the G20 process so it would be more timely, actually move the process along, and actually reach a result in terms of debt sustainability for the countries. So there's still a lot of work to be done, and the details matter. We're talking about Zambia, who has been present at the meetings and has not, they've been working for 2 years with the world community in order to restructure their debts. It's in the context of a very successful economic program in Zambia. They've done more than most any other country in terms of having fiscal discipline, having growth-oriented policies that make it possible to strengthen the economy, but they still haven't been offered the text of a debt restructuring that would reduce the debt burden. And so we're hoping that there will be a memorandum of understanding, an MOU, which is the goal of this process, that could come out this week or next week. China would need to go along with it, and that's an important part of this. The private sector creditors are critical and have to be deeply engaged. We discussed yesterday the World Bank is providing implicit debt relief through the IDA process. You know, IDA is the fund for the poorer countries, and it constantly is giving substantial relief, often through outright grants. For example, in Zambia, we will be starting on July 1. All of our assistance to Zambia will be in grants. And so then it's incumbent on the other creditors, and particularly on China, to come forward with actual debt relief that will allow the country to become sustainable. I can go through each country, but it's specifics. In Ghana, we are looking for the creditors committee to form. In Ethiopia, for there to be structural reforms that can get to the IMF program, and that leads directly into the exchange rate system. They're using a dual exchange rate system in which the funding of the official exchange rate for a narrow group of people is very expensive. And so to move away from that so that they're can be stronger growth within Ethiopia. My view is if they improved the exchange rate system, capital would come back to Ethiopia. Right now, the exporters keep their funds outside Ethiopia, and so if they unified the exchange rate, which is under discussion within their economic program, then there would be a flood of investment back to Ethiopia, and that would improve substantially a desperate situation that's going on in East Africa. East Africa is facing famine. It's facing very, very hard climatic conditions and this shortage of fertilizer that's going on around the world because of the high price of and lack of availability of natural gas. So these are all challenges within the debt framework. Thanks.
World Bank President David Malpass at a news conference in Washington. As part of the World Bank IMF spring meetings, he'll be leaving his position at the end of June. An article in The Guardian has this: China, which has emerged in the past decade as a significant bilateral creditor, has been reluctant to offer debt relief unless the World Bank and the IMF are prepared to take a financial hit themselves. Beijing also says there is no point in providing relief if the money saved goes to pay off private creditors. They want private sectors to be fully engaged in the process, something that has not been the case so far. That from The Guardian in Great Britain. Wall Street today, the Dow up 383, NASDAQ up 236, S&P up 54. President Biden announcing today an expansion of Medicaid and Affordable Care Act health insurance to include coverage for those in the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That allows some undocumented immigrants who arrived in the country as minors to live and work in the United States. President saying it's amounting to health care is a right, not a privilege. The annual Wounded Warrior Project Soldier Ride visiting the White House today. That's a multi-day adaptive cycling event. It started in Annapolis, Maryland. It'll end in Lorton, Virginia. Spokesperson for the project, Megan Wagner, telling ABC 7 here in Washington, D.C., much more than just physical activity and cycling. This is an opportunity to engage with one another and peer support, build camaraderie, build our confidence through their physical activity, but also connect with their community. Greeting them at the White House, Vice President Kamala Harris.
For people, anyone who has faced a difficult time or hardship, who have suffered wounds that are physical and those that are emotional, we often look to and point out as an example our veterans, of how people can overcome in a way that puts them back out there to compete and to fight and to stand tall and strong, whatever might be some of the physical limitations that they experience. This is who you all are. And so we have with us today, for example, a veteran who returned from her deployment and found healing through sports, and who will soon compete in the Air Force Warrior Games. We have with us an active duty service member whose battle with mental health challenges inspires him to serve as a mentor for young children. We have with us a veteran who, after 30 years of service, founded and now runs a nonprofit that works to bring home those missing in action. This ride is a reminder of how far you've come and how far you're going.
Vice President Kamala Harris with the riders of the Wounded Warrior Project at the White House. She was joined by her husband, Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff. And after their remarks, they sounded the horn. The Wounded Warrior Project is in its 20th year helping post-9/11 warriors, their families, and caregivers. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.